A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and I want to start right in the middle of it, because the experience he describes is one of those moments that tells you something about an entire city. Friday afternoon, Jerusalem, he's carrying boxes home. Some maniac starts screaming at him. Barely intelligible Hebrew about Shabbat, mixed with a racist tirade about Arabs. And Daniel's point isn't that this was uniquely terrifying. His point is that, if you've lived in Jerusalem for any length of time, this isn't novel. It's ambient.
That's the thing that should stop you cold. Not that someone had a bad encounter, that happens in every city. It's that the encounter isn't a one-off. It's a symptom of something that's been metastasizing in the urban fabric itself. The municipality fences off streets on Shabbat. Whole neighborhoods become functionally off-limits if you're not visibly observant enough. And now, the ultra-Orthodox bloc holds a city council majority for the first time. That happened in 2024.
Which means the people who want to enforce religious norms on public space now control the mechanisms that allocate budgets, zone neighborhoods, and decide which streets get blocked. The social coercion and the municipal coercion have merged.
It's not just intra-Jewish tension anymore. Attacks on Catholic clergy in Jerusalem have surged. We're seeing a city that was supposed to be the global model of interfaith coexistence becoming the global test case for religious extremism in urban governance. Daniel's question is essentially, what do you do when this shows up on your own street? And are there any cities that have actually dealt with this successfully?
He also says something that I think gets at the emotional core of this. He says if it weren't for his wife Hannah, who works here and loves the city, he would have left for Tel Aviv years ago. That's not a policy position. That's a person saying the place he lives has made him feel unwelcome in a way that's cumulative and exhausting.
The fact that secular residents are leaving in droves, that's not anecdotal. There's data on this. The Jerusalem Institute for Policy Research projects the Haredi population will hit 40% of the city by 2030. The city's growth is entirely driven by ultra-Orthodox and Arab populations. Secular Jerusalemites are voting with their feet.
The question isn't just, why is this guy screaming on a Friday? The question is, what are the mechanisms that turned a single aggressive encounter into a systemic feature of urban life? And what, if anything, has worked elsewhere?
That's the setup. Personal experience, systemic machinery, and a city that's supposed to be the counterexample. Jerusalem markets itself as the city of three faiths, the place where coexistence is built into the stone. But what's actually happening is that one group within one of those faiths is increasingly dictating the terms of public life for everyone else.
The city of coexistence framing has always been a bit of a brochure fantasy, but now it's actively collapsing into something closer to a cautionary tale. The tension isn't really Jew versus Muslim versus Christian in the way tourists imagine. A huge share of the friction is intra-Jewish, ultra-Orthodox imposing norms on secular and less observant Jews who happen to live in the same postal code.
Daniel's experience captures exactly why that distinction matters. He's Jewish, he's walking on his own street, and someone decides he's not Jewish enough in his public behavior. That's not interfaith conflict. That's one vision of Judaism claiming authority over public space and punishing anyone who doesn't comply.
Which means we're talking about two tracks that have converged. Track one is social enforcement. The guy screaming on Friday. The glares, the sense that certain streets belong to certain people after sundown. Track two is municipal abetment. The actual fences, the road closures, the zoning decisions that turn social pressure into physical barriers.
The school segregation piece is where these tracks merge most clearly. When the municipality approves a Haredi school in a mixed neighborhood like Kiryat Ha'ovel over the objections of secular residents, it's not just an education decision. It's a signal about whose claim to the neighborhood is legitimate.
The arc we need to trace here starts with what Daniel felt on that Friday. The raw experience of being told you don't belong. Then we pull back to the mechanisms that make that experience systemic rather than random. Then we look at cities that have faced versions of this and what they tried. And finally, what secular residents can actually do beyond just moving to Tel Aviv.
Because the moving to Tel Aviv option is itself part of the problem. Every secular family that leaves shifts the demographic math a little further. The city doesn't just lose residents, it loses the tax base, the cultural infrastructure, the political counterweight. The feedback loop accelerates.
What we're really talking about is the failure of urban pluralism when one group accumulates enough demographic and political weight to stop negotiating and start dictating. The question is whether that trajectory can be bent, or whether Jerusalem is just running a script that other cities should be studying closely. The first thing to understand is that none of this happened by accident. The guy screaming on Friday isn't just some outlier. He's the sharp edge of a demographic wave that's been building for decades. The Jerusalem Institute for Policy Research puts the Haredi population on track to hit 40% of the city by 2030. That's not a projection pulled from nowhere. It's driven by birth rates that are roughly triple the secular Jewish rate, plus steady in-migration.
Right, and the birth rate number is genuinely staggering. The average Haredi woman in Israel has about 6.5 children. The average secular Jewish woman has just over 2. You don't need to be a demographer to see where that math leads. Every decade, the political center of gravity shifts a little further.
Which is why this isn't just a story about rude neighbors. When a population block grows that fast, it accumulates political power almost automatically. The question is, what it does with it.
In 2024, we saw exactly what it does. The ultra-Orthodox bloc won a city council majority for the first time. The media line documented this pretty thoroughly. It wasn't a narrow squeak, it was a structural shift. Budget allocations started moving toward Haredi institutions. Zoning decisions began favoring Haredi neighborhood expansion. Secular cultural events saw funding cuts.
The mechanism isn't mysterious. You get the numbers, you organize them into a voting block, you take the council, and then you use the municipal machinery to reshape the city around your norms. It's democratic in the narrow sense and deeply illiberal in practice.
Here's where I think the trade-off gets difficult. The Haredi community has legitimate needs. Large families need larger housing. Religious education requires its own school infrastructure. If you're Shomer Shabbat, you want streets near synagogues to be quiet and car-free on Saturdays. None of that is unreasonable in isolation.
The problem is, when we need our own infrastructure, it turns into we get to decide the rules for everyone's infrastructure. The road closures are the clearest example of that line being crossed. The municipality physically fences off major arteries on Shabbat and holidays. This isn't a neighborhood politely agreeing to drive slowly. It's a municipal barrier that says, your car doesn't belong here, regardless of what you believe.
For someone like Daniel, who isn't trying to drive through Mia Shireen blasting music, who's just on his own street, the barrier is social, not physical. But the message is identical. The municipality has already signaled whose norms govern public space. That emboldens the guy on the street.
The Kiryat Hayovel case makes this concrete in a way that's hard to ignore. Secular residents fought the establishment of a Haredi school in their neighborhood. They argued it would fundamentally change the character of the area, attract more Haredi families, shift the local culture, accelerate the secular exodus. The court ruled in favor of the school anyway, citing educational diversity. The Times of Israel covered this.
This is where the legal abetment piece gets maddening for secular residents. The courts aren't saying religious coercion is fine. They're saying the Haredi community has a right to educational infrastructure. Which, again, in isolation, is defensible. But when you stack it on top of the demographic shift, the political capture, and the spatial enforcement, it adds up to a pattern. Every institution, democratic, municipal, legal, is pushing in the same direction.
It's the convergence that does the work. No single mechanism would be enough. The birth rates create the numbers. The voting bloc converts numbers into council seats. The council controls the budget and the zoning. The courts validate the zoning decisions, and the guy on the street sees all of this as permission.
Then there's the violence piece, which operates on a different register but feeds the same reputational collapse. Attacks on Catholic clergy in Jerusalem have surged. We're talking physical assaults, spitting incidents, vandalism at churches. This isn't intra-Jewish friction anymore. It's a broader signal that religious extremism in Jerusalem doesn't just target secular Jews who don't observe Shabbat. It targets anyone outside the narrowest definition of acceptable.
Which makes the city of three faiths, branding not just hollow, but actively misleading. If you're a Catholic priest getting spat on in the old city, the brochure about coexistence reads like a joke. And that reputational damage has economic consequences. Tourism, foreign investment, the ability to attract the kind of young professionals who keep a city's tax base alive.
When Daniel asks what motivates this, I think the answer has to be, it's not one thing. It's the interplay of demographic inevitability, political organization, and legal permissiveness. Each piece reinforces the others. And the result is a city where secular residents increasingly feel like they're renting space in someone else's theocracy. That feeling of renting space in someone else's theocracy, that's exactly what the 972 magazine piece captured. They quoted a secular Jerusalemite who said, "I feel like a guest in my own city." Not a visitor, not a newcomer. Someone whose presence is tolerated rather than belonging. That's the emotional consequence of all these mechanisms working together.
It's a line that lands because it names the power reversal. You grew up here, you pay taxes here, your family's been here for generations, and suddenly you're the one who has to justify your presence. The norms you grew up with are now the ones that need defending.
The secular flight numbers bear this out. The city's population growth is coming entirely from Haredi and Arab communities. Secular residents aren't just leaving in a trickle. It's a steady, measurable outflow. Every departing family is a data point in a feedback loop. Fewer secular voters means less political counterweight, which means more policies that drive secular residents away, which means fewer secular voters.
The economic dimension of this is brutal and under-discussed. The secular population is disproportionately high income and high tax paying. They're the ones funding a lot of the municipal services. When they leave, the tax base erodes. That means less money for the secular institutions that remain. Cultural centers, non-religious schools, public amenities that serve the whole city. The city becomes less attractive to the exact people it's losing, and the spiral tightens.
What does Jerusalem become in the meantime? Internationally, the reputation is shifting hard. The surge in attacks on Catholic clergy is making headlines everywhere. You can't market yourself as the city of coexistence when priests are getting spat on in the street. Tourism takes a hit. Foreign investors look elsewhere. Young professionals, the kind who might have stayed and built careers here. They look at Tel Aviv and see a city that actually wants them.
Which brings us to Tel Aviv, because it's the obvious counterweight. Tel Aviv has positioned itself as the secular alternative. Liberal, open, creative. The startup city. The place where nobody cares what you do on Shabbat. And it's working. It's absorbing a lot of the young professionals and creatives that Jerusalem is bleeding.
Tel Aviv isn't a solution to Jerusalem's problem. It's a lifeboat, not a repair. And it has its own deep flaws. The cost of living is eye-watering. Housing prices have made it nearly impossible for young families to put down roots. There's a different kind of social homogeneity forming there too, just secular and expensive rather than religious and insular. Moving to Tel Aviv solves one problem and creates three others.
The question isn't, where do secular Jerusalemites escape to? The question is whether Jerusalem's trajectory can be bent. And that's where looking at other cities gets interesting. Belfast is the one that jumps out at me. A city that was defined by sectarian division for decades, where neighborhoods were no-go zones for the wrong identity, and where the violence made Jerusalem's current tensions look almost restrained.
The Good Friday Agreement in 1998 is one of the more remarkable pieces of institutional engineering in modern history. It created mandatory power sharing. Protestants and Catholics had to govern together, not as a courtesy, but as a structural requirement. Cross-community voting rules meant that major decisions needed support from both sides. And there was a Bill of Rights that protected individual freedoms regardless of communal identity.
The key difference, though, is that Belfast's division was ethno-national, Protestant versus Catholic, but really British versus Irish identity. Jerusalem's division is religious observance based within the same ethnic group, at least for the intra-Jewish piece. That's a different kind of cleavage. And the Good Friday Agreement was imposed by external actors. The British and Irish governments, the UA, who had leverage that doesn't exist in Jerusalem's case.
Right, nobody's going to impose a power-sharing agreement on Jerusalem's city council, but the structural insight is still valuable. Mandatory coalition government, cross-community voting requirements for major decisions, a charter that protects individual freedoms. These are mechanisms that could theoretically be adapted. The question is whether there's the political will to create them before the demographic math makes it impossible.
Then there's Mumbai, which I think is the more instructive case study because it didn't need a peace treaty. Mumbai has profound religious diversity. Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Jains, Parsis, and it's had its share of communal violence, some of it horrific. But the city has managed to maintain a secular public sphere. The secret, as far as I can tell, is institutional. The municipal corporation, the courts, the police, they enforce a secular public order consistently enough that nobody gets to claim the streets as their religious territory.
The Brihan Mumbai Municipal Corporation, the BMC, is a fascinating institution. It's one of the richest municipal bodies in Asia, and it has a kind of technocratic independence that insulates it from being captured by any single communal interest. The courts in Mumbai have been aggressive about protecting public space from religious encroachment. And the police, for all their flaws, don't look the other way when religious groups try to enforce their norms on the street.
Civil society is the other piece. Mumbai has a dense network of civic organizations, neighborhood associations, and activist groups that actively resist religious encroachment on public space. It's not just top-down enforcement. It's a culture of secular public life that gets defended from below.
Which is where the contrast with Jerusalem gets sharp. Jerusalem's secular civil society exists, but it's fragmented and demoralized. The political parties that represent secular interests don't coordinate effectively. The neighborhood associations that could push back often find themselves out-organized by heritage groups that have been doing this for decades. Mumbai's secular institutions are robust because they're actively maintained. Jerusalem's are atrophying because they're being steadily abandoned.
The lesson from Mumbai isn't, be more like Mumbai. It's that secular public space doesn't maintain itself. It requires institutions that are strong enough to resist capture and a civil society that treats public space as something worth fighting for. Jerusalem has neither right now, or at least not at the scale that could counterbalance the demographic and political trends we've been describing.
That brings us to the uncomfortable question that sits underneath all of this. Can Jerusalem reverse this trajectory, or is the script already written? The demographic projections don't offer much comfort. 40% heritage by 2030, and that's before you factor in the feedback loop of secular flight. At some point, the math just takes over.
Which is why the actionable stuff matters. It's easy to get fatalistic about demographics, but the ultra-Orthodox didn't stumble into a council majority. They vote as a bloc. They show up. Secular political parties in Jerusalem are fragmented. They spend more energy competing with each other than building coalitions, and their turnout is abysmal.
This is where I get a little preachy, but I've spent enough years in civic activism to know it's true. The municipal level is where public space gets decided, not the Knesset, not the Prime Minister's office. If secular residents organized even half as effectively as the Haredi parties do, the balance would shift. It's not a numbers problem yet, it's a coordination problem.
The second piece is legal infrastructure. Jerusalem needs something like a public space charter, a binding set of rules that guarantees access regardless of religious observance. Ban the Shabbat road closures outright. Don't negotiate them block by block. Require mixed-use zonings or no neighborhood becomes religiously homogeneous by design. Protect secular cultural institutions from budget retaliation.
Mumbai essentially does this through its courts and municipal corporation. Nobody gets to fence off a street because it's Friday afternoon. The public order is secular by default, and religious observance happens within that frame rather than replacing it. That's the inversion Jerusalem needs.
Belfast offers the political mechanism, mandatory power sharing that forces groups to govern together rather than one bloc ruling the other. Mumbai offers the institutional backbone, courts and civic bodies that defend secular public space. Jerusalem needs both, and right now it has neither.
For listeners who live in cities with their own religious tensions, London, Paris, New York, wherever, the battle is at the municipal level. Attend council meetings. Join your neighborhood association. Support the civic organizations that fight for secular public space. The guy screaming on a Friday afternoon feels like a lone maniac, but he's operating in an environment that either tolerates him or doesn't. That tolerance gets decided in zoning hearings and budget meetings.
The uncomfortable truth is that if you wait until the screaming shows up on your street, you've already lost several rounds of the fight. The time to organize is when the mechanisms are being built, not when they're already enforcing norms you can't reverse.
That's the question that sits with me after all of this. Not whether Jerusalem can be fixed tomorrow, it can't, but whether the trajectory is locked. If the demographic projections hold, if the political capture deepens, if the secular flight continues, there's a version of this city in 20 or 30 years that's functionally a Haredi enclave with a tourism industry attached.
The thing about demographic projections is they're not destiny, but they're close. You can bend them with policy, with political organizing, with institutional reform. You can't ignore them. The 40% number by 2030 isn't a ceiling, it's a waypoint. What happens after that depends on whether the feedback loop gets interrupted.
Which is why I keep coming back to the warning function here. Jerusalem isn't just a local story. London has neighborhoods where religious norms are increasingly enforced socially. Arab disputes, modesty posters, pressure on businesses to close for certain holidays. Parts of Paris have seen similar dynamics. New York has school board fights that map almost perfectly onto the Kiryat Hayavel case.
The pattern is the same everywhere. A religious community grows, organizes, starts making claims on public space. The secular majority assumes it'll work itself out. By the time anyone organizes a response, the zoning decisions have already been made. The school has already been approved. The street closures are already routine. Jerusalem is just further along the curve.
What Jerusalem shows is that the curve doesn't flatten on its own. Every concession to religious control of public space makes the next concession easier. Every secular family that leaves makes the next departure more likely. The question for London and Paris and New York isn't whether they'll face versions of this. It's whether they'll recognize the early mechanisms before they're as entrenched as Jerusalem's.
I think that's the note to leave this on. Jerusalem is a cautionary tale, not because it's uniquely broken, but because it's uniquely far along a path that plenty of other cities are starting to walk. The time to build the institutions that protect secular public space is before the guy shows up screaming on your street.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the Phantom Time Hypothesis fringe literature, some proponents claim that the entire city of Mainz was retroactively inserted into historical records to cover a 300-year gap fabricated by the Holy Roman Emperor Otto III, Pope Sylvester II, and the Byzantine court, and that the city's documented medieval prominence is entirely a historiographical invention designed to make the calendar discrepancy add up.
I have so many questions, and I'm going to ask none of them.
That was a lot.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumintop. If you want to send us your own prompt, maybe one about phantom cities that never existed, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everything.
I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll be back.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.